May it please the court. 3 years ago, this court found that respondent had lied to two of his clients, having told them that litigation had been filed and that they had received favorable judgments. In one case, that the litigation had been filed, and in another, that the case had settled favorably, when in fact, neither of those things were true. When Mr. Fleming was thereafter placed on state suspension with probation, he was presumably given the benefit of the doubt that those were isolated incidences of deceit and misrepresentation. What this case before you today demonstrates is that they were not anomalies, and Mr. Fleming has made a practice of making gross misrepresentations to his clients.
These events occurred prior to that suspension and probation, is that right?
Some of them did. Some of the client interaction occurred prior to the suspension, but the OCDC didn't necessarily receive complaints until after that suspension had taken place. There are two unusual aspects to this case. The first being that there's no question that the majority of the misrepresentations that were alleged in the information actually took place. This is not a situation where a credibility determination had to be made. Mr. Guerra was represented by the respondent during a time when Mr. Guerra was incarcerated, and the respondent made unsecured telephone calls with his client at the Department of Corrections. Those calls were recorded and preserved, and we listened to approximately 80 telephone calls between respondent and his client where these misrepresentations took place. It started from the very beginning with respondent promising to visit his client in prison and not visiting because of a snowstorm or a sick grandchild or because the respondent was sick. It proceeded from there with respondent telling his client that he was going to enter appearances in cases that he never entered appearances in. He told him that he was getting ready to file briefs, getting ready to file motions that he never filed. It progressed then to the point where respondent was telling Mr. Guerra that he had initiated litigation that had never been filed, and that he was expecting court hearings to be set, or that he was expecting favorable rulings from the court when there was no pending litigation.
Rather than looking at the individual allegations and individual misconduct alleged, opposing counsel asked the court to look generally at whether he benefited his client, and he makes arguments that he did in various ways, and that therefore sanctions aren't appropriate. Can you address that?
Yes, I think that respondent confuses what he believed was best for his client with what the client actually wanted. When Mr. Guerra hired respondent, Mr. Guerra had received a conditional release date of March 2008 when he was going to be released from prison. In April of 2007, 1 year prior, Mr. Guerra believed that 1 year longer in prison was just too long, and he wanted his attorney to file a writ of habeas corpus to overturn the conviction. Was the chance of that going to be very successful? We don't know. But that was respondent's job, to make his client aware of what the probability for success was in that case and what the likely outcome would be, and then if he chose to continue representing Mr. Guerra in that capacity, to do what his client asked. Instead, respondent has argued that he felt that pursuing some of this civil litigation where they were requesting monetary damages, that that would somehow compromise Mr. Guerra's conditional release date. And what respondent fails to recognize is it was never Mr. Guerra's goal to be released on his conditional release date. He wanted to be released prior to that via habeas corpus or early parole.
And my understanding is, and maybe that was unrealistic, and maybe Mr. Fleming's advice should have been followed by Mr. Guerra, but that he misrepresented in the telephone conversations to his client
Absolutely.
What he was doing and didn't tell him he was following a different strategy, but told him he had filed things he had not filed.
You're absolutely correct. Clearly, in answering your previous question, the correct path, a course of action for Mr. Fleming would have been to say, I don't think this is in your best interest. I think we should do something different. And here's what my suggestion is. Instead, he lied to his client, creating fabrications about litigation that didn't even exist, and moreover, was withdrawing huge lump sums of money from this client's trust account, having purported to bill for the work that he wasn't doing. And that kind of brings us to the second unusual aspect of this case, which is Mr. Fleming's refusal to acknowledge the seriousness of the and the egregiousness of this conduct. Throughout the pendency of the litigation, he has maintained that he feels good about the work that he did for his client, saying, I got him a farm. I got him money left over when he got out of prison. Well, those things were never Mr. Fleming's to give. Those things belonged to the client. And when respondent came into possession of over $200,000 of Mr. Guerra's money, in one phone call after the next, we hear Mr. Guerra say, I'm really worried that that money is not earning interest. I want that money transferred out of your trust account. Do something with it. And Mr. Fleming presented him some paperwork from Morgan Stanley. Mr. Guerra signed the paperwork and returned it back to his attorney, and then Mr. Fleming never submitted it to Morgan Stanley. He never created an account. When Mr. Guerra became anxious about the fact that his money wasn't accruing any interest, and this was a large sum of money.
The trust account, the rule, anticipates large sums of money in one person's account to provide that they do not have to put, they can get interest-bearing accounts outside of the trust account.
Correct. Had Mr. Fleming been following the trust accounting rules, he would have put this money in a separate account, which is exactly what his client directed him to do. And it's not just that he didn't do it, it's that he lied and said he did. He told Mr. Guerra that the reason Morgan Stanley wasn't processing his account was because they were conducting a terrorist background check on him, when in fact, he had never even submitted the paperwork to Morgan Stanley. And he told Mr. Guerra that all his money had been transferred to interest-bearing T-bills at a bank, when in fact, Mr. Fleming maintained control over that trust account the entire time.
Did Mr. Guerra ever state why he gave him all this money? Was it the prepayment of criminal fees, or was it for safekeeping? What was the purpose of Mr. Guerra giving this all this money from the estate to his lawyer?
Well, first of all, Mr. Guerra was told by his attorney that that Mr. Fleming wasn't going to take the case unless he could demonstrate that he could.
What
could
he?
I'm sorry. Mr. Guerra was told by Mr. Fleming that Mr. Fleming wouldn't represent him unless he could demonstrate that he had a substantial amount of money. I think he initially told him $50,000. And Mr. Guerra said, I have this inheritance coming from my father, but I'm having trouble getting the money from the estate. And that's one of the things that respondent has pointed to as, you know, a positive thing that he did for his client. He was able to get this money from an estate where Mr. Guerra had been unsuccessful otherwise. Mr. Guerra was incarcerated. His options for communicating with the estate attorneys in California were pretty limited. So he relied on Mr. Fleming to get that money.
And Mr. Fleming did assist him in that
he
regard.
He did assist him.
But you're saying once he got the money and took out his fees for that, he needed to then provide the money back to his client.
Correct. Once he got the money from the estate of California, it was his job under the rules to put that in a separate interest-bearing account for his client, and certainly
after charging
to avoid
a fee.
Lying about
it. I mean, he could charge a fee for getting that money because Mr. Guerra couldn't get the money without him.
And he did charge a fee, and that was not considered part of our information or part of the disciplinary charges that were brought against respondent.
Go ahead.
No, he charged a fee for helping with that estate. He charged a fee for going to the closing of the farm and doing that kind of work. And those things were not considered, those things were not included in the information because we had no reason to believe that he hadn't earned those fees. What we do have reason to believe is that he withdrew over $36,000 for work that he never completed and that he was unable to show that he had done anything for, not research, not memorandum, nothing. And I think that the fact that he hadn't completed that work is corroborated by the fact that he felt the need to lie to his client.
Now, does it matter that he get a state suspension and complete his probation? He doesn't get a clean slate. It's still on his record for future violations, even though his probation was completed and from the last charge.
He is still on probation. He has not completed his probation, and part of that was because we had these pending charges. And I think that the probation ship has sailed. We see that those were not isolated incidences of him misrepresenting facts to his client. This is something that he's done now with multiple clients. And
does your burden of proof is it lower that he violates? Does a violation go in probation? Do you have to prove as much if he's on probation to suspend his probation?
To revoke his probation?
Because if you revoke his probation, he goes back to 6 months suspension.
Right, which is just not sufficient in terms of protecting the public in this case.
But these events occurred prior to his probation, so these events are not a violation of his probation.
Correct. Some of them are.
Which ones occurred during his probation that you're saying were a violation of it?
Well, I'm sorry. I'm differentiating between the actual client conduct and the time that the case is.
Did he do something? I understand you think what he did merits suspension, but I didn't understand you were alleging he violated the terms of his probation through this conduct.
No, we didn't allege that. We didn't allege that he had violated the terms of probation. What we've alleged is that, and I misunderstood Judge Teitelman's question, is that something like probation or a state suspension, while it may maintain his record, would not be enough to protect the public, because quite frankly, the OCDC nor the bar have any mechanism for correcting or helping with the deficiencies in Mr. Fleming's character that have led to the misconduct.
Before you sit down, is there also an allegation that he misrepresented to a tribunal that he had his client's permission to dismiss the lawsuit?
Correct. There were that he has made misrepresentations to the OCDC and to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals when he told them that he had his client's permission to dismiss the appellate case, when in fact Mr. Guerra knew nothing about the dismissal and most certainly had not agreed to the dismissal.
And finally, really quickly, there was a really long delay here, and he says he's prejudiced by that. Can you address that?
Mm-hmm. There was a delay in this case, most certainly. It took longer than a lot of cases, and there were a number of factors that contributed to that. One was just the number of complaints that we were investigating at the same time. The CDC, Alan Pratzel, had testified at hearing that the number of complaints, the fact that the previous disciplinary case was up in front of the court at the time, had he been suspended during that time or disbarred as a result of that case, it would have changed the way that he handled
it. A lot of these complaints occurred before Mr. Pratzel was the OCDC, and there was a record of a lot of delays in cases before Mr. Pratzel eliminated the delays. Is that correct?
Were some of these
complaints before Mr. Pratzel was
I don't know that that was the case in this particular instance. Like I said, there were 80 telephone calls that ranged in length from 45 minutes to an hour. We had to listen to all of those calls, get them transcribed. There was just a lot of evidence in this case. But at the end of the day, the delay in that case is considered a mitigating factor, if anything at all, because I don't think that Mr. Fleming can demonstrate that he was actually prejudiced by this delay. The recordings have preserved when those conversations took place and what took place between the clients. So,
thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
I've been here many, many times, but never one more. I'm under the kind of
scrutiny. Could you speak closer to the microphone?
Yes. I've been here many, many times, but never under the scrutiny that I am with this one. First of all, I want to clarify something. None of the allegations in this proceeding are alleged to have occurred while I was on probation. They occurred prior to that. I've been on probation 3 years, and the reason that it's 3 years instead of the 1 year that the court ordered is that they will not allow me to get off probation as long as there is any complaint pending. So what was a one-year probation has turned into a three-year probation, and Alan Pratzel testified at the disciplinary hearing for this that he had no problems with me on probation. I've done everything I was supposed to do, including periodic...
Did they have the authority to extend probation beyond the terms of the last discipline?
Well, I don't think so, but he does.
But don't the probation terms say that if other complaints are filed, they'll be investigated before probation
is
ended?
I didn't see anything like that, but at least Mr. Pretzel believes that he can extend the probation as long as there is some kind of complaint pending against me. I also would like to point out that the court's order on that, on those previous cases occurred on June 2011. That was 3 years ago. Nevertheless, the complaints in this case have lingered on. The Guerra complaint was 6 years old from the date of the alleged conduct. The Younger complaint was 7 years old. McVeigh complaint was 4 years.
And how do you claim prejudice from that?
Well, first of all, I didn't remember what I had told Tim Guerra on the phone. I listened to the recordings, and I'm shocked at what I said to him. You have to understand where Mr. Guerra was coming from at that time, as I have spelled out in the brief.
But if you lied to your client, and there's multiple instances where you said you did something that you just didn't do, and it wasn't just, gosh, you were going to do something later that day, but numerous things over many, many months.
Well, I realize that. I'm not saying that I'm without fault for having done that. I ask myself why I did that, and I can tell myself now that I wanted to keep Mr. Guerra quiet and calm because we had a deal in place that his conditional release date would not be revoked.
That's his choice. I mean, let me ask one other question. Are you satisfied that all the conversations that you have with Mr. Guerra were actually transcribed, or whether maybe other, you clearly communicated with him 80 hours, whether other conversations that may not have been transcribed?
I don't think all of them were transcribed, and I certainly don't think we have all of them in evidence. I was talking to Mr. Guerra on a daily basis. My objective when I was talking to Mr. Guerra was to calm him down so that he didn't screw up and blow what was then in place as his conditional release date. Keep in mind that when I got on board with Mr. Guerra, he had received four memorandums from the Department of Corrections saying that if he did not complete MOSOP, he would not be released on his conditional release date. And that was a rule. That was a rule. I sent a letter to the Department of Corrections pointing out that, number one, I questioned whether what Mr. Guerra did was a sexually violent offense. He was charged with producing pornography. Whether that's a sexually violent offense requiring MOSOP, I don't know. The Department of Corrections said it was, and they continued to say it was. It wasn't until after I got involved that they backed down from that and said, no, they weren't going to require him to complete MOSOP.
Mr. Fleming, did you have incentive to use your trust account like an operating account because you had outstanding judgments against you?
No, I couldn't have done that because my trust account was not really my account. It was a trust account for the firm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was Herzog Krebs trust account that I was using.
How did it benefit his conditional release for you to keep that trust money in there when you told him you would put it in a separate account?
Well, it wasn't in there all that long. The OCDC has charged that he missed out on a year of interest. He missed out on interest. The money went in there in March of 07. Most of it was paid out in order to purchase his farm and house and everything in October of 07. So at the most, you've got 7 months in there, not a year.
What's the reason you told them you'd applied to Morgan Stanley and they were looking at this?
I did apply to Morgan Stanley, and that's exactly what they told me. They sent me the forms but said, we got a problem here because this guy's in prison.
And opposing counsel says you did not.
I did. I talked to...
What does the record show to support either of those positions?
I just testified. I gave the name of the investment advisor who I spoke with at Morgan Stanley. And I didn't think that Morgan Stanley would take the money. As far as not putting it in a CD, I did not know how long that money would be okay to leave that in a CD because Guerra was saying, I want to buy a house. I want to buy a house. The worst thing I could have done was tie that money up for 6 months or a year and then have Garrett say, I didn't do right by him.
But you understand, it may be your advice to him on all these things and what you wanted to do was right, but you can't misrepresent to him what you're doing with his money.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm not saying that, I'm not trying to justify my misrepresentation. I'm saying this is a reason that I wasn't too keen on putting money, investing money for Garrett. He would accuse me of doing something wrong. The other thing that has not come to surface here, the reason Guerra wanted the money in the trust account was so that he wouldn't be tagged with a lien by the state to pay for his incarceration. Now, I got no problem keeping money in a guy's trust account, but if I start spreading it around, if I start putting it in CDs or treasury notes, then I'm coming pretty close to money laundering. And I was very uncomfortable with doing that.
Can you address the finding that you misrepresented, that you had your client's consent to dismiss the case in the Eighth Circuit?
I thought I did.
And why did you think you did?
Because I had talked to him at Bowling Green. I talked to him on the phone. I also talked to him at Bowling Green on numerous occasions. And I was very strong about dismissing these cases so that he didn't get fouled up on his conditional release date. This is something that was difficult to get the OCDC to understand. His only way out before the end of his term was conditional release. He wasn't going to make parole. He would have had to do the additional 3 years. I thought it was a gift that the Department of Corrections said, okay, we'll back off on not requiring him to do MOSA. Why did they do that? Well, I had sent several letters to them. I had talked to his institutional parole officer. I had said, you're going to buy yourself a lawsuit here because he doesn't think that his offense is a sexual offense that would require MOSA. He doesn't think it's a violent sexual offense. Also, he continued to assert that the young men that he had videotaped in exchange for drugs. He had given them drugs. We're talking about 20 occasions here, where he gave a young man, 17 years old, drugs and videotaped them masturbating. He said they were 17 and that they're adults and that shouldn't be an offense. Well, he had already tried that. He had tried that in several post-conviction motions that didn't work. He was going to do 3 more years unless he got out on his conditional release date. And everything that I did was geared to that. I didn't do the right thing. He came out ahead because he got released three years earlier. As far as his inheritance, I had here a file that I introduced to me at the hearing. They didn't want to hear about it. This is a file that I generated trying to get the money out of his estate. I also have a file that I introduced here which are all most of the grievances he had filed while he was in prison. Now, these are important for two things. They sort of track his public safety concepts case where people were picking on him and they were subjecting him to sexual abuse, all that kind of stuff. All of this is contained here, and I had to review all of that. You just don't pick up a petition and run to court with it. I had to make sure that he had exhausted all of his administrative remedies, which I did. I also noted in there that they had taken a position that he wasn't going to get out of this conditional release date because he hadn't completed MOSA. Now, there's four memoranda in there saying that. That's what I was dealing with. He ultimately got out. The other thing that the hearing panel did not consider was the real estate. He wanted to buy this house. Wasn't that easy. I wish it...
Did you make an offer of proof? Did you...
Yes.
Why,
yes
did you say, here I want to present as an exhibit and said we're not going to accept it?
Yes. I told him why I wanted these in there, because it was substantial time that I spent and a substantial benefit to him to get this done. He got the money from the estate.
Well, what didn't they say it wasn't relevant to whether you had misrepresented to him and that's what they were pursuing?
That's what they were saying.
And so... Assuming you gave him the benefits, that still doesn't justify.
Doesn't justify. That was another matter.
So how do we deal with that?
Well, I think you have to look at the total picture. I mean, I did make misrepresentations. I hope you look at the total picture and say, did I do right by the client? Was he, did he come out better off than he would have if I had not been on the CEO?
And is that how you would practice on the future? It's okay to misrepresent
as long as you end up with a good result? No.
So how do we know that? I mean, you seem to be saying that was a good judgment.
Well, you know that because I spent 3 years on probation and nobody had any complaints about anything I did. I'm 72 years old now. I've been practicing law for 47 years. I probably had well over 2,000 clients during that time. Not many of them have made any complaints. Some of them have.
During the time you were on probation, were you subject to any contempt proceedings or judgment? Debtor examinations?
No. Before I was on probation, Michael McVeigh had filed contempt proceedings against me. That never went anywhere. That's a different story.
Have any additional complaints been filed against you while you're on probation?
No. No, there was one complaint that was filed with the fee dispute committee, and I responded to that.
But not with OCDC.
No complaints have been filed with OCDC during that time. I think I've behaved myself rather well for the last 3 years. My biggest concern right now, to tell you the truth, like I say, I'm 72 years old. It's been a good run. I've worked for the Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division Federal Public Defender, taught law school, done a lot of good stuff. It's been a good run. And I probably would hang it up in about 2 years anyway, to tell you the truth. I mean, my grandkids are growing up too fast. I just as soon be with them. But the thing that bothers me most about a suspension or a disbarment now is that I've got about 25 or 30 clients, most of whom are in prison, ironically, because of guys like Guerra, who got out of prison with my help. That word spread all over the place. Now I'm a hero because Guerra beat the system and got out of prison without doing Mossad. I get a lot of calls from a lot of clients, and I've got about 25 of these guys on the line now. I don't charge them much, if anything. I don't know what the hell they're going to do if I can't represent them. Some of them have good claims. Some of them have abuse claims and claims that they were put into ad seg without any cause, and I believe a lot of those. And I've been running my tail off tracking those down. But I don't know what these poor individuals are going to do if I'm not there to help them. And that worries me more than anything else. I'd suggest to you that what you might want to do is just extend my probation another 3 years with some super supervision or something, and whatever makes you feel comfortable. But I could do that. I would be happy to do that. I do quarterly reports now. I could do monthly reports. I haven't talked about McVeigh, and I haven't talked about Younger. But I'll tell you this. Nobody was more disappointed than me that the Supreme Court did not extend the Blakely decision in the Younger case to make it retroactive. I still think they may do it, as I briefed out in my brief. Younger got a life sentence for dealing drugs. He was accused of killing and beheading a young man. I don't think he killed the young man. Certainly didn't behead the young man because they found him with his head intact. And I think a witness lied. And I tried to do everything I could. Nothing bothered me more than Louis Younger getting life. He should have been sentenced to prison, maybe 15, 20 years, something like that. Not life for dealing methamphetamine. I wanted to help him. As a matter of fact, I just sent him a package of stuff where the Attorney General has said that you can now file for application of the new sentencing guidelines, and a lot of these drug sentences are going to be reduced. So I sent him a package of stuff, say, follow through on this. This is something that you might get some relief on. So that's where I am there. As far as what I did for him, I have attached as an appendix, the memorandum that I drafted during the year that I was struggling with this, is to try how to fit him into the Supreme Court decision that said that the Blakely decision that said that you can't have a judge determine sentencing facts. It has to go to a jury and it has to be alleged in the indictment. I struggled with that. Lately, there's been some movement on it. I still think they may come around. If it comes around, the first person I'm going to contact is Louis Younger and say, I probably can't represent you, but get somebody to represent you.
Is there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Well, thank you for your patience, and I'm sorry if I get emotional about this, but that's...
It would be very nice and give everybody a warm feeling to believe that Mr. Fleming's motives are altruistic in terms of these clients. However, Mr. Fleming pointed to Louis Younger, and he's a perfect example of what has transpired in these cases. Mr. Younger went through the appeals processes. He was out of options. He paid Mr. Fleming $10,000 to draft a successive 2255 motion for him. Years passed, and Mr. Fleming knew from the beginning that the chances of success with that were slim to none. There was no new evidence. The law had not been made retroactive. Once he failed to produce a 2255 motion for his very vulnerable client, and Mr. Younger went ahead and filed something himself, Mr. Fleming refused to give back the $10,000. You know, when Mr. Fleming talks about Mr. Guerra, that he was never going to make parole, that his conditional release was his only hope, that's fine, but Mr. Fleming told Mr. Guerra that he visited the parole board, that he spoke with a representative of the parole board, and that the parole board member believed that Mr. Guerra should be released early. He said he expected a formal decision to come down any time. And in reality, he had done none of the things that he said he did, but for that particular work, the imaginary work that took place with the parole board, he charged Mr. Guerra $7,225, none of which was refunded. I appreciate that Mr. Fleming is telling the court that he's concerned about his clients, but his past conduct would indicate that he was concerned about the money that he made from these disenfranchised people who had no other options. There were some factual discrepancies, which I will just clear up. In addition to the $215,000 inheritance that Mr. Guerra received, he received an additional distribution of $95,000, which is why that money, which over $100,000, was kept in the trust account for almost a year. Mr. Fleming never submitted the paperwork to Morgan Stanley, nor is there any indication that that was done. The case that we have not talked about is Mr. McVeigh, and I will just touch on it briefly since it is part of the informant's information. This was simply a case where they could not come to a decision over the fees. Mr. Fleming told his client that he would not charge him for the initial consultation, for the document review, or for attending a hearing where Mr. McVeigh represented himself pro se. In the end, he decided to keep Mr. McVeigh's $5,000 and not refund any of that, and said it was because he had earned that money via document review, initial consultation. The DHP found that Mr. Fleming's testimony with respect to that was not credible, and it's the reason that we're asking he be disbarred.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.